Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, or whenever you happen to be listening to this, welcome to the Film Realist Podcast, the film and TV podcast from a complete nobody. That is hopefully for somebody. My name is Kyle Naranya, and welcome to episode 200 of the podcast! Woo! I'm very excited to be celebrating 200 episodes of the Film Realist, and to do so, I will be reviewing The Devil Wears Prada 2. And then to round out the episode, I have a questionnaire that a ton of listeners responded to that I can't wait to get into. I will be responding to listener mail and question of the week responses. Because this is going to feature a feature film review, there will be a non-spoiler segment of the podcast as well as a spoiler segment. Each part of the podcast will be listed with a time code in the episode description, but let's put on our high heels and get our strut on when we get into The Devil Wears Prada 2 spoiler-free review.
Runway needs to take control of the narrative of the Speed Pass story and restore credibility. And he thought someone with my expertise would be a good idea. But I thought that for sure you had approved and were excited. And that's why I came in here all like, oh.
The Devil Wears Prada 2 falls into that category of a legacy sequel. It is 20 years since the release of the original, and with so much time going by, that raises expectation. You get a lot of fans excited about a return to a world that they're familiar with, that they've seen over and over and can quote and can reenact. And The Devil Wears Prada, the original, is one of those pop culture films that absolutely permeated the zeitgeist. And a lot of expectation can lead to a lot of people being disappointed. Fortunately, commercially, as well as critically, the film was fairly well received and had the second biggest opening worldwide of 2026 so far, which, considering the anticipation, that is definitely a positive. And I feel mostly positive about this film. What's really difficult when making one of these, not just the expectation, but in delivering something that feels familiar while also exploring the characters' new ways in which they interact and where their roles are now. 20 years is a long time. Think about how old you are right now and how different you were 20 years ago. For myself, I would be 15 years old. That's not even an adult. You were in such a different phase of your life, even separated by one decade. And one of the aspects of The Devil Wears Prada 2 that I'm really grateful for is it doesn't just keep the world in a bottle with the way that it represented the fashion industry in the first film. Things have changed. The tech industry and magazines, journalism, all of those different aspects of our culture have changed dramatically. You could argue for the worse. And Devil Wears Prada 2 explores that with this new world. Each of the characters have grown and they are different yet familiar, and you need that in a movie like this where people have been waiting to see it, but they want it to feel like a warm hug. In an instance which is ironic because obviously the devil, Meryl Streep's Miranda Priestly character, is not somebody who necessarily would be delivering that, although the irony of saying the devil and a warm hug is not lost on me at all. But getting to see these characters 20 years later, where are they now? How are we going to drum up a situation in which our four leads are going to interact again? The worst thing you can do with a legacy sequel is have it feel completely redundant or a mimic of what works about the original. Familiarity with nostalgia while also moving the story forward can be really difficult, where you want to show things because you understand the fandom behind a property. You don't want to tell the same story. You can use the same framework to tell a new story. And I think the movie really does do that, where all of the expectations and moments that fans have been drawn to for two decades now with this movie are presented to you. There are enough callbacks that feel genuine within the movie. The worst thing that you can do when making a legacy sequel is feel as if you are talking down to your audience. You like this, here we gave it to you again, enjoy it. That kind of cynicism can't work, specifically in a movie like this, where the evaluation on the fashion industry and the media landscape is so different than it was even in the printed media that was presented in 2006. And I know it doesn't feel like a long time, but it 20 years is a very long time. And you get these characters that don't feel as if they've been frozen in carbonite, that they have changed. All of their relationships have moved on, as we've seen in the clips for this. Some people have completely forgotten that others have existed. But you want to put them in situations in which they feel familiar, yet you're exploring new aspects of those characters. Because if you just give us the thing we've seen before, it completely defeats the point of telling another story with these characters. You want to know that those characters you fell in love with are still present while also telling an interesting story about where they are now. And going back and forth with the movie, you could definitely be heavily critical of how much of this movie feels maybe too familiar, but the overall structure of a sequel, and that's what makes sequels inherently kind of confusing, is you are delivering on something that people have already accepted they like. We're going to give you more of that thing. Well, do you want more of the exact same thing? Or do you want something that feels familiar but is something new? A lot of the times, those things don't work, where a sequel can wind up feeling completely different. Or, as I've said, it can wind up feeling exactly the same. But 2026, where we are culturally, within pop culture, within all these different industries that were presented in the first film, have changed a lot. This movie gives an insight into its perspective on how all of these different industries have changed. And not in a way where I think it's cynical, it's much more realistic. And the character journeys of each of our main cast are rewarding. We get a chance to spend more time with them, but we want those characters to feel as if they are moving further along. They can't be learning the same lesson they learned before. You need to build off of that foundation that you got from the original. Yes, the characters can feel as if they're sort of resetting, and that's all right, because when you are spending time with somebody that you are familiar with, as we are with Meryl Streep, Anne Hathaway, Emily Blunt, and Stanley Tucci, there's that reset to allow the audience that might be new to this movie to get the opportunity to learn about them, but then to be on the same level as the audience that fell in love with them so many years ago. And the movie presents that. There are so many legacy sequels that don't take the opportunity to move characters forward. They just give you the thing you saw before, and that's supposed to be good enough. And I commend David Frankel and Aline Brosh McKenna for not doing that. This is maybe the hardest way in which to continue a story, when a lot of time has passed, as well as being the same people to bring the next adventure in those characters' lives. And when it comes to portraying these characters 20 years later, that's another hurdle that our main cast successfully overcomes. When you haven't played that role for more than 20 years, it can feel as if the actor is impersonating their older work, where they know what they did before, but don't find the same way to inhabit or even be that character 20 years later. It feels as if they're creating an impression of themselves, which only hinders a movie being successful, because those characters that felt so well realized in the original wind up feeling as if you see somebody who is just older and impersonating the person you fell in love with. And the main cast feels as if they've grown with these roles over the 20 years, as opposed to them, they themselves are revisiting them again with the two decades having gone by. The characters' positions professionally have moved on, and getting to explore all of that and how those relationships differ because of the time that has gone by. The movie really effectively manages to give us another window into the lives of these people for however long the movie takes place, but also rolls the ball down the hill, as opposed to has somebody stand up top and go, here's where it is, we're not going to tell you anything else because this is exactly where it needs to be. It is rewarding for longtime viewers who love this movie and have rewatched it over and over and over again. To some would say potentially obsessive, But one of the things I absolutely adored about watching The Devil Wears Prada 2 is it really isn't in that windmill of, here's Devil Wears Prada 2, and we're definitely going to set up the third one. Because when a franchise gets reignited into pop culture, usually it is building to something else. And it is a really big frustration of mine, because when you happen to do that, you don't always wind up getting the best story possible because things wind up being held back. Well, we can't do that because that would defeat the point of telling more stories. By the conclusion of this film, it does feel as if the story that they wanted to tell has concluded. People have moved. The board is no longer on the table. The game is over. And where they find themselves at the end of the story, their journey has come to an end with what we are going to be seeing in this film. Is there a possibility of doing more with them? I'm sure that everybody involved might think, yeah, we maybe could do that again. But the novelty of exploring with these characters again might wind up in the same sort of realm that Top Gun Maverick 2 or Top Gun 3 could wind up being in, which is the reward of seeing them again has been paid, and it does not feel nearly as rewarding if you just happen to see those characters again. We have another adventure with the Devil Wears Prada crew, and it is rewarding for new viewers as much as it is for long-time viewers. And you get to see the stylistic fashion world in 2026 and a perspective on that world, as opposed to just doing it 2 years or 4 years later. That's not nearly going to work the same. So overall, I think this is a lot of fun. This is a movie which its thesis statement is to entertain and just be unequivocally fabulous to look at. You get the fashion that you would expect. You get the world that you would expect. You get some cameos that you may or may not expect. And you have fun. It's not an Oscar-nominated drama that's going to blow your mind. I couldn't believe the twists and turns. It is the lens to deliver the people we like with some things that definitely are a commentary on modern society, but not in a way where it feels condescending or tedious or edutainment. It is a entertaining 2 hours with characters that people fell in love with 20 years ago, and here they are now. That will do it for my non-spoiler thoughts on The Devil Wears Prada 2. Now let's sink our teeth or our stiletto into the real meat of the movie.
It's really remarkable. A senior editor at Runway, you.
Yep. We're all so thrilled.
Mm-hmm. You know what's funny is you've changed. You have. You're much more confident. Oh. Kept those eyebrows, though, didn't you?
Spoilers for The Devil Wears Prada 2. The main reason that we see all these characters back together again is after 2 decades of being an actual journalist, Andy is fired because, as we've seen, and this is one of the aspects of the film's perspective on what's going on with printed media, is that there's a lot of consolidation and all these organizations are taking over, combining, leading to a lot of people being laid off. A lot of journalists who have explored real world issues not really having the platform to do that anymore. And even after winning an award, she gets fired. Miranda, Meryl Streep's character, is under fire for a puff piece that ultimately was about a company that was actually using sweatshops. And because of this, and this is an aspect of the film that I thought was really nice, which is we obviously see that she winds up getting hired, as you would have heard in the clip that led into non-spoilers. But the reason that Andy was actually hired to help Miranda and work in the feature department of Runway is because of Nigel suggesting it to Irv, who is the Runway chairman that you did see in the original film. That's one of my favorite parts of the movie, was even some of the supporting cast was still brought back, and they have a relevant part of the story. They're not just there to be like, hey, remember that guy, or remember this guy. Each of them has a role to play, and all of the new characters, outside of one, I think are really effective in the way that they flesh out this world. Andy is not the same person she was when we saw her in 2006. As you would have also heard leading into the spoiler section, She's a much more confident person. She's had success as a writer. She's become that person that she wanted to be when we met her at the very first film. Each character has grown to some degree. You can argue some of them maybe haven't as much, but they're not who they were as 23-year-olds. They are who they are now as 43-year-olds. Although, what's really interesting is I think the best payoff ultimately of the whole movie is truly through Nigel's relationship with Miranda. In the first film, of course, he was up for this incredible job to work with, I believe it was James Holtz, who was going to be expanding his organization. Ultimately, Miranda gave that job to somebody or suggested James get somebody else for that job, leading to Nigel to be in the role still that he was at Runway. And we get a line of dialogue in the movie that Miranda's done that to him more than once. And what this movie does for Miranda is much more interesting than maybe what we get from her in the first film, which is she really does thaw much more as a person. She got divorced in the first film. She has a new husband in this film, played by Kenneth Branagh. And what's really great about what Kenneth brings to Stuart is he's somebody who does seem to inherently understand who Miranda is as a person. She is this career-driven woman that clearly has let her personal life fall apart, and it's affected the relationships she's had with her own daughters, leading to a divorce, which we saw in the first film. And it's really heartwarming to see a character who is not put off by a successful woman, somebody who's intimidated by that. Oh, this is not necessarily the norms of, it's probably like the 50s, but it's a much more modern sensibility to see that character. And I love Kenneth Branagh. He's been in a lot of great films, and that relationship's just different than all the other ones we see in the movie, which is really funny because Emily Blunt spends most of the movie almost more as an antagonist to our main characters at Runway, which does paint her in a different light. She was seemingly forced out of Runway, is now working at Dior, which puts her in a position of power over Miranda because that's one of the ad companies that are, they pay for advertisements with Runway. Runway is now a digital platform. Gone are the days of printed media, and we get an intrinsic look into that idea that, of course, so many people would now be a part of. Some of the guests of this podcast would be aware of that world where you're looking for something of meaning, but also the virality of the clicks, the social media things, having something go viral and bringing in subscribers and readers and really dealing with how the news has changed. Social media has changed everything, much more digestible in shorter and smaller clips. And the perspective on really somebody's opinion has changed because everybody can deliver their own opinion. And they're fighting in a world that is definitely of the old guard, trying to stave off the new guard. And the new guard in this instance is played by BJ Novak, which made me laugh because there's an interview where he was given the role and somebody asked if he's playing the bad guy. And while I wouldn't say he plays the bad guy, but when his father passes away, much like other media conglomerates, he wants to consolidate what Runway is and reduce the operating costs because this form of media is no longer bringing in the money that it used to. And Runway is not the glowing beacon that it was when it was presented in the first film. So we get a perspective on how things have changed, but we get from a character like Andy who sees the good in strong feature editing, writing, talking about things that matter. And what's really awesome about that perspective is it really does connect her to Miranda in saving Runway from being bought by a billionaire, shocking, played by Justin Theroux, who is just, I'm getting slightly tired of seeing Justin in these roles over and over again. He does sort of fit into this bumbling guy who's successful. And I get that we are going to make fun of the one percenters because it's very easy to do so. But after Glass Onion and this and countless other films, I get that we want to put a magnifying glass on what they've done to media and pop culture and even politics. It's just a character that ultimately is really only there to serve a purpose, which is Emily Blunt wants him to buy Runway so that way she can run it. And I like that character because Andy and Emily in the movie are two sides of the same coin, where Andy really did take what she learned the first time she worked at Runway, but has used all those lessons and molded herself into the new Andy that she is, where Emily sees it much more combatively, where I was pushed out because of Miranda's opinions of me, and this has led me to where I am, which is not where I want to be. And she's much more antagonistic in what she's trying to achieve. Not in a malice way at all, but you get to see the two proteges of the first film kind of go to battle. And that's really entertaining because it pits the characters in a way we haven't seen them before. And as I said in non-spoilers, not in a way where it feels as if you're presenting characters we're familiar with and changing them completely, where they're completely unrecognizable. We understand the history that's happened. And that is a great aspect of a successful legacy sequel, which is there have been things that can happen, and you tell them in a way in which we feel as if we've been included in the time that's passed, as opposed to small window of time, nothing interesting has happened in between. But a lot has happened. We know that Nigel has been looked over for job after job after job. Emily, or I guess her name is Emily in both things, has not achieved the goal in her life, which is apparently to run Runway. And Miranda, because of her relationship with Andy and going through something that is preventing her from achieving the goal that she had for herself in this movie, which is being in charge of global everything for all of the runways. And there's a company, what is the name of the company? I can't remember, but the actual whole company that own Elias Clark, that's what it's called. And through Andy's drive to get important journalistic features out there while still trying to achieve the goal of getting meaningful clicks, leads to an interview with Sasha Barnes, who ironically is the ex-wife of Justin Theroux's character, Benji Barnes, played by Lucy Liu. And it is through Andy's work that allows Miranda the opportunity to actually interview her and be their get out of jail free card. It is a relationship Miranda only has because of Andy. And that brings those characters closer to a moment where they really get to see that they're much more alike than they are different. And that does help Andy come to a realization that she doesn't necessarily want for herself the life that Miranda has had for herself. Because similar to the first film, and this is one aspect where I understand what the film is trying to do, but I don't think it's necessarily effective because we just spend less time with him, which is Patrick, I'm assuming it's Bramall characters, Peter, who's Andy's love interest in this film. They spend time together and there's a natural chemistry, specifically because he's also from a different career path. He is an architect who designs how buildings are sort of rehabilitated so that way they can be used again. I guess almost gentrified. But their back and forth are good, but the conflict does really feel quite manufactured, which is frustrating. And something I mentioned in non-spoilers that I will mention here more thoroughly is the foundation of the movie and the way in which it's structured is very similar to the last film. There's the inciting incident, which really kind of lays the groundwork for everything else. There is a fashion gala, I guess, showcase at the end of the film. In this one, it is in Milan as opposed to Paris. And there is a jockeying for who's going to control Runway or Elias Clark. It's revealed later on, of course, that Lucy Liu buys the whole thing, the conglomerate, and not just Runway. And I understand people thinking it's too similar, but what's funny to me about that is this has sort of been the cycle for printed media for quite a while. So the way in which this feels almost cyclical over 20 years, this is what happens. But ultimately, where Andy is left is not where she was at the end of the first film, which is Andy realizing she doesn't necessarily want to be in that world, where Andy, at the end of The Devil Wears Prada 2, has come to the realization that she does. She likes the relationship that she's developed with Miranda now, and that she can do things she wants to while being around the people that support her, and that Nigel ultimately is the reason she got brought back, because it was Nigel who suggested Andy be the person to help rehabilitate Runway's image after the puff piece turned out to be about a sweatshop. So the fact that all the characters are in different places by the end, Emily is fired from Dior, winds up working for, I think it's Chanel by the end of the movie, and she's come to the realization that maybe Miranda was right about what she was capable of, and that she is actually quite sad that her and Andy weren't friends in the long run, even after they were separated, and the armor that Emily had presented in the first film, and for a significant portion of this film, has worn away. She's much more a person, also after being left by Benji. So you get a rewarding adventure with these characters in something that feels familiar enough. Is this going to leave you gobsmacked by every twist and turn? Absolutely not. But neither would the first film. This is a Devil Wears Prada 2 sequel, not The Godfather 2, not a continuation of The Wire or The Sopranos or even Dune, something insane in which you are expecting twists and turns. It is supposed to feel fun and recharge you with the entertainment that you got from a movie 20 years ago. And the movie does that. I had a really great time with this. Just these characters and these actors bouncing off of each other, it's worth the 2 hours. Do I necessarily need a third? Probably not. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. I had a really good time. And I think for anybody who was a fan of the original, you'll be getting that too. That will do it for my spoiler thoughts on The Devil Wears Prada 2. Now let's get to the episode 200 questionnaire results. Let's get to the answers from the podcast questionnaire. The first question was, what was the first episode you listened to? First answer we have here is Across the Spider-Verse, then Daredevil, Batman Mask of the Phantasm, 4K review, The Little Mermaid. I'm not sure, but I think it was Justice League Crisis on Infinite Earths, the Black Panther 2 podcast, they should have recasted, Rebel Moon, Avatar live action. We have here, it's a little hard to remember because I think I've listened to all of them. Number one, She-Hulk, another one for The Little Mermaid, Superman and Lois season 4, a bunch of episode 1s, and then Spider-Man No Way Home. What was your favorite episode? There were a bunch of people who voted in, and it looks like we had a tie between Hoppers and Last of Us season 1. A bunch of votes for other episodes of the show, but I love that one of the episodes that people loved was one with the kids. Every time Melody and Sawyer join me and giving me their perspective on a movie, it warms my heart that it's clear that they have a passion for film, which is obviously something they got from me. Next, who is your favorite guest? It was a tie. We've had a lot of amazing guests on the podcast, and I'm grateful to everybody who's wanted to spend time chatting about a film or a TV show, but the tie was between Dylan Pollack and Rob Keyes. I would say two of our mainstays of the podcast. I wouldn't be here without the amazing friends that I have that want to contribute and spend time with me. Andy, Ben, Chris, Dylan, Keen Machine, I guess a bunch of Melodies and Sawyers, as well as Rob and Dylan, of course. Sean, who's been on the show, Kofi, just an amazing group of people who love film and TV just as much as me. Next question, what is Kyle's most controversial review? Sinners, but only because you weren't literally screaming with excitement. I need more shrieks about the movie from Kyle. Probably Last of Us Season 2, Transformers 1, Ninja Turtles, I'm guessing they mean Mutant Mayhem. And then we have one here. It says, honestly, I don't know if I have one. I think Kyle's most controversial review. It's very subjective. The Flash is here. He was hard on Ezra Miller, but he put on an acting clinic and he was cleared of those things he was accused of. Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning. Really? Is that controversial? I don't think so. The Peacemaker season 2 wasn't awesome. House of the Dragon season 1 review. SpongeBob. I don't remember. Did I? I don't even think I did SpongeBob. How to Train Your Dragon live action. This wasn't on the podcast, but Rock of Ages. Wicked for Good being just mid. Apparently I went too easy on Running Man. And last, that Cobra Kai is a good show. All right. What is the funniest moment of the podcast? Personally speaking, it's just generally funny to me that each time we podcast, we spend 2 hours recording and then 2 to 4 hours just chatting. Brian Manili, I know that's you. let's see here. Having the kids on, being super analytical for Zootopia 2. Anytime Kyle has to read a Scotty Cameron novel. I love that. Scotty, don't listen to them. Please don't talk. Don't listen to them. Let's see here. The ranking of the Arrowverse shows. Rob Keyes, Kyle proceeds to tell him, hey, this is a family type of podcast. And then he has to edit out 2 minutes later. Rob is cursing like a Tarantino film. True. My Russian accent, apparently, from Craven the Hunter. People love anytime the kids come on. And then Venom the Last Dance, Kyle hating the use of other actors. Boston accents from Castlevania. That was super funny. A lot of this just says they love the kids, which I love. I love that so much. Which question of the week was the hardest to answer? This question? Anime you'd want to be adapted? Which How I Met Your Mother star on Shrinking? Favorite Batman suit? Which is the best Stephen King adaptation? Spidey suits in here. Another adaptation. Oh, you know what? Reading these, obviously a lot of the questions have to do with recasting. And then we've got one here. What is Michael B. Jordan's favorite, or what is your favorite Michael B. Jordan movie? So many good ones. And the last question, what is your favorite trailer reaction? First one is, I don't normally watch those. Sorry. That's okay. You don't have to apologize. Spider-Man Brand New Day, Super Mario Bros. The movie. Because it's the freshest one, I love how Kyle dressed up. Oh, and they put in the link. Which one is this? I don't actually know. Could this be for Spider-Man Noir? It is for Spider-Man Noir, where I was in a Spider-Man costume. So if you didn't watch that one, please check that one out. We have Superman, when Kyle saw Guy Gardner, and he said, I hate that guy. Venom the Last Dance, Kyle being annoyed at pre-trailer trailers. Minecraft movie, Mortal Kombat 2, Devil Wears Prada, Moana live action, yikes. Lanterns, Kyle Chandler is the GOAT, and then Deadpool 3. Thank you to everybody who contributed their answers to this. It's super fun to see what people have thought of the podcast and where we're going with it. And I'm really excited that I can say now, because there's been a number of people who have been asking, based on my work with DC Studios and the Multiverse of Color. I've written some stuff there. You can check that out. The links are connected to the bio site for the podcast about covering news. Because there's a lot happening with the film and TV industry right now. And week to week, sometimes I get a chance to talk about that on the Multiverse of Color, and sometimes I don't. I've really enjoyed talking about how I feel about trailers and announcements. And so moving forward, starting on episode 202, there is going to be, moving forward, a News of the Week podcast section. So if there is a news announcement, a trailer, a casting you want me to talk about, please email the show. I would love to see what people want me to talk about week to week, because it will just add to what is an ever-growing podcast. It's not going to be the same thing all the time. It might be different. 100, 200, 50 episodes from now, I don't really know, but I'm excited that we're going to be changing the podcast for the future. It's going to give me an opportunity to react to things much more on the spot, which is something I really appreciate doing. So yes, yeah, send those things in. But to anybody who wanted to contribute to that questionnaire, to the podcast, for anybody who's been a supporter of mine, I'm getting emotional. This week that I'm recording this, the YouTube channel for Film Realist crossed 500 subscribers, which, if you don't know, that's the first step in monetization, which is not ultimately been the goal of this show. I love film and TV, and I wanted to share my passion for that, for this medium, with people who want to hear what I have to say about it. And the fact that there are people week to week that tune in to hear what I have to say, I'm incredibly grateful for that. It's not that support is needed, because I would be doing this if I didn't have any listeners. But I have incredible listeners. Anybody who's listened to one episode or week to week, or maybe just watches trailer reactions on the social media stuff, it's awesome that I get to share this with people, but it's so fun to get to have that back and forth, and to continue to do that week to week is amazing. Not missing a week sometimes is challenging, but I do my best, and fortunately for over 2 years now, haven't done that. But I love this show so much, and it's not going anywhere. As I've said, it's going to be changing, and I'm hoping for the better. But I just wanted to say thank you to everybody, and the episode's not even over. I'm going to try to put myself together for the listener mail and question of the week responses.
Can I ask you a question?
Just one?
There's something I really need to ask you.
I ask the questions, you answer the questions.
Why do you ask questions to which you already know the answers?
Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Damn it.
This week's question of the week was, what is your favorite outfit worn by a protagonist in a film or TV show? Andy Babak wrote in, this is definitely one of mine, and it's Drew Barrymore wearing fairy wings, and I believe that's from Ever After? We also have some answers on Spotify, which is always a place that you can submit yours. We have one from Scotty Cameron, which says, I'm going to go with Ryan Gosling's Scorpion jacket attire in Drive. The pairing of that jacket with a jean jacket underneath with a pair of jeans for pants drove home the idea that Drive was a cool everyman. I also like the attention to detail of his outfit getting bloodier and dirtier as the film progressed. That's definitely something that I would feel so bad for when it comes to the costume department, to have to worry about that. That would be an absolute nightmare. We have a comment here from Joshua Drake Randall, which says, solid review. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening to episode 199. Dylan Pollock writes in, if I'm talking best outfits from a movie in general, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension has some wild fashion choices that kind of leave it iconic, but also Powerline from A Goofy Movie comes to mind. So do with that what you will. It's funny because so many characters, you can't think of them outside of outfits. Rocky in the gray tracksuit, whether that be Luke in his kind of hodgepodge outfit by the end of Star Wars, or Obi-Wan Kenobi's hermit outfit wind up becoming what the Jedi wore. There's so many characters. I'm a huge Doctor Who fan where it's just like, that's the look. Sometimes it does change. Matt Smith's one of those characters where his outfit changed. And I would argue by the end of it, I know Rain loves his brown tweed, but the purple one was pretty spectacular too. But also, how do you go wrong with when you absolutely nail a superhero costume? There's something to be said for the costume department, and obviously they put in the hours when it comes to something like The Devil Wears Prada 2, because man, I don't understand high fashion. I don't pretend to. I'm a hoodie, t-shirt, and nice athletic leisure pant kind of guy. I've got jeans. It's very rare that I wear a suit. I might actually have to get a new one for an event coming up next year, but I'll get to that when I do. I know a lot of people spent more of their time for this week answering questions for the questionnaire, so I appreciate anybody sending in anything. If you have a question for me, you can email the podcast, filmrealistpod@gmail.com. You can at the social medias, just make sure to include Film Realist, because that will be the one that I check for the podcast. You can send a DM of something you'd like me to discuss. It doesn't necessarily even have to be news. But on to this week's question of the week. It's a simple one with the review that's going to be Mortal Kombat 2. Who is your starter in Mortal Kombat? Who do you choose as your fighter? You already know how to answer, but before we end the show, I'm very excited that this is going to be a two-week podcast week. Obviously, this was the Devil Wears Prada 2 episode, But make sure you're subscribed on YouTube or your preferred podcast platform. If you're watching the video, please give it a like, because tomorrow, if you're listening to this on the day that it drops, I will be releasing my spoiler thoughts on Daredevil Born Again Season 2, and I will be joined by Multiverse of Color and DC Studios podcast friend, Jedi Mike. So make sure you check that out. It's already been recorded. Phenomenal discussion on what we saw from the second season of Daredevil Born Again and where it could be going. Thank you to everybody who listens to this, who contributes to this, who wants to hear what I have to say. My name is Kyle Naranja, and I will see you next time.